Welcome to the History of California podcast. I'm your host, Jordan Maddox. Today we have Dr. James Buckley on the show. Dr. Buckley is an associate professor and venerable chair in historic preservation and the director of the Historic Preservation Program at the University of Oregon, Portland. He has over 25 years of experience in the development of affordable housing in the Bay Area, including the adaptive reuse of several historic buildings for residential uses. Dr. Buckley previously taught at MIT and UC Berkeley and holds a master's degree in city planning and a PhD in architectural history from UC Berkeley. He's been a member of the board of directors for the Vernacular Architecture Forum and the Society of American City and Regional Planning History. He's joining us today to talk about his new book, City of Wood, San Francisco and the Architecture of the Redwood Lumber Industry. Here's a description of the book. California's 1849 gold rush triggered the creation of the instant city of San Francisco as a base to exploit the rich natural resources of the American West. City of Wood examines how capitalists and workers logged the state's vast redwood forests to create the financial capital and construction materials needed to build the regional metropolis of San Francisco. Architectural historian James Buckley investigates the remote forest and its urban core as two poles of a, quote, regional city. This city consisted of far-reaching networks of spaces produced as company owners and workers arrayed men and machines to extract resources and create human commodities from the region's rich natural environment. This was a fascinating podcast. It includes not only the history of the development of San Francisco from an architectural perspective, but also relevance to current issues around planning, development, affordable housing, and a lot more. I know you'll love this conversation. Let's go meet Dr. James Buckley. Dr. Buckley, your background is in planning and architecture. How does that inform your writing of history in maybe a non-obvious way?
Yeah, so my first degree, my first master's is in urban planning, and I was really focused on housing. And in fact, my first career was building affordable housing in the Bay Area. So in one way, I think that really got my business sense going and set me up for this work later because really focused on the nuts and bolts and the financing and that sort of thing. So later on, I went back and got my PhD in architectural history. And it's an interesting kind of architectural history at Berkeley. It's not just famous architects and famous buildings. It's ordinary environments, buildings you don't really think about too much, but helps you understand the world. So that was a great background in looking at the regular landscape and trying to figure out what goes on with that. So both the planning aspect and the unusual architectural history aspect, I think, set me up for looking at the redwood lumber industry in a different way that people have in the past.
Okay, before we get into redwoods, I've got a couple questions because this is of personal interest and interest in our state right now around historical preservation. You have a lot of discussion right now about abundance and increasing housing supply and stock. As a former affordable housing builder, I'm sure you're well versed in these subjects. I want to ask you though specifically about historical preservation. How have you seen that field evolve over time? I know it's gone through some changes over the years. What have you observed?
I retired a couple of years ago as the director of the Historic Preservation Program at the University of Oregon. And it's just been fascinating to work with students and professionals in this field recently because it's changed a lot. And I think a lot of the criticism that housing people about historic preservation is based on what was happening before and not on what's happened lately. Lately, people are much more interested in things that aren't necessarily physical. They're interested in things that are what we call intangible, like how people have done things in certain ways. And that really lends itself to thinking about some of the ways in which we can treasure and hold on to traditions like people of various cultures, people of diverse cultures. So a lot of what people are doing in historic preservation now are saying, this business has been here for a long time. It's part of the Italian-American culture. Can we help save this business, not just the building that's in it? So I think that is really helpful and goes more to trying to preserve all of the traditions we have in our communities, not just the physical artifact of the building.
That's you segued into my next question. Right now I'm reading through Michael Wood's incredible book, The Story of China. And one of the first chapters, he has a discussion about how they historically preserve. And he contrasts it with kind of Western approaches where it's more building or object focused. And he, just as you said right now, talks about how there are places that are thousands of years old, but what's more important is the story associated or the mythology associated with a particular landscape and not the building. So, are you saying that we're moving closer in that direction where we're more concerned about stories and narratives over physical infrastructure and architecture?
Yeah, the Historic Preservation Group in San Francisco Heritage has done a great, very innovative job of trying to move us towards those non-tangible aspects of things. They've invented this idea of the cultural heritage district, in which we ask groups to say, what are the stories that are important in your community? And yes, the physical form of the city can change, but how do we hold on to those kinds of ideas through other kinds of rituals or ways of telling stories and that sort of thing? So, yes, you're right on that historic preservation is being criticized by people who say we need to build more housing. But I think that preservation people at the same time are saying, yeah, sure, the city needs to change. People need housing. But we also, in doing that, can remember these stories, these things people have done over time. What makes a place? What makes San Francisco? So we're in an evolution right now.
Okay, two more questions about historic preservation. Where I am in Fresno, in Central California, most of the buildings are that are historically preserved tend to be like professionals or like important people in the town's like mansions. There's this Kearney House that's where the Fresno Historical Society is. Can you talk about the politics of selection? What goes into picking a place?
So one of my favorite examples is in San Francisco in the Tenderloin. There was a famous altercation, let's call it, among transgender people and the police in the 1950s in this cafe called Compton's Cafe. And it's not something a lot of people know the history of, but it's very important to transgender people who say, this is where we stood up for ourselves. We were being hassled and harassed. We said, no more. We don't want to do this. And then some changes came along, and there was a bar near that site that a developer wanted to tear down and build new housing. And that there was a negotiation, and the decision was, yeah, we can have a new building, but let's have some kind of memorial to this community and this neighborhood within that. And so people are selecting different kinds of things. They're saying, we don't want to just do the mansion of the famous business person from the 19th century, and we don't necessarily have to preserve it as it is. We want to try and figure out what are the stories that are important to everybody in the community. How can we try and keep that memory alive and not just the biggest building and by the most famous architect?
Okay, last question. What are your thoughts about adaptive reuse? So let's say you have a famous Italian deli and then a proprietor of an Indian restaurant wants to take it over and convert it into an Indian restaurant, but preserve some of the historical information, important components of the physical plant, if you will, of the building. Do you think that's a way to allow buildings to adjust with the times, but try to preserve some elements, or do you not pursue that as a good
Yeah,
idea?
I think any preservation person would say the best way to preserve the physical piece of it is to have a use that works. There's no sense in trying to continue a use that's just not economically feasible. So it's better to try and find some way to say, let's keep the elements we can and make it into a new use. When I was building affordable housing, I was quite pleased with a project we did in San Francisco that was one of the nicest Christian Science churches that I knew of in the city. And it was going to be torn down for market rate condos. And I was able to convince people to say, a lot of space inside, we could reuse it for a senior housing, which we did. But then some people said, oh, it's no longer really a church because you've changed all the space inside. Yes, you're right, but we've maintain the exterior, which is a part of the neighborhood and people like and want to remember this, but we've created a new use inside that preserved it in a way that people could enjoy it and use it into the future. So that's a kind of example of how adaptive reuse is very important. for these
Okay,
kinds
let's
of
jump into City of
documents.
Wood. In the work to write this book, you have to consult a lot of different source material, some available in traditional places like archives and libraries, but periodically you'll engage with industry archives, which are different spaces. Can you talk about some of your work with industry archives and what that actually looked like in terms of your research process, but also just access in general?
One of the delights of this process was to find a lot of different sources because we don't really have a lot of records. Not many lumberjacks wrote their thoughts down every day in a diary, just said, "Today I felt oppressed by my corporate boss," or something like that. So you had to use a lot of different. In fact, I did find a diary of a lumber guy in San Francisco who talked about his experience in lumber yards here. But for the most part, I use a lot of the building records to try and understand what's going on and let the environment try and tell me. But there are lots of other things as well. One of the joys of researching history in California is the Bancroft Library, where just almost anything has found its way there over the years. So they had company records of how many shipments they made to a certain merchant, and they had tons and tons of photographs. So that was really a great resource. Both the San Francisco Public Library and the Humboldt State Library have wonderful photo archives that are online and very useful. So there were a number of different things I had to use. One of my best sources was a dime novel written in 1910 by a guy who became famous as a sort of dime novelist guy, but his early experience was with a lumber company in Eureka, and it was a very cleverly disguised rivalry of the old paternalistic kind of lumber company owner and the new corporate raider kind of owner. And he talks about this and describes the process. So I learned a lot about how the process worked for milling lumber and also about the rivalry between these two opposed kind of company owners.
And what was it like to look in company archives and look in industry archives? What did that look like?
Oh, you just feel like you're right there at the time. You can see the person writing to this guy saying, "I didn't get the last shipment," or "the last shipment wasn't quite right, and we need more of this kind of thing." You can see the sort of character of people that they write in their letters, and you just get a sense of how much material is moving and how it's doing. So it's a wonderful opportunity. You just get lost in the archives and feel like you're back in the 19th century with them.
That's amazing. I'm curious, and this is something I try to impart to listeners when we have these conversations around this idea of historiography, that we're always engaging in a long-term conversation about a subject. And I'm curious, in your preparation and research for this book, what had been published on the logging industry in California of note thus far? And what do you feel like you're adding to that conversation?
I feel like there was a lot of data. There was a lot of information. For example, there's been some good books about the redwood lumber industry that talked about who was doing what when. So that was incredibly helpful to get the lay of the land. What there hadn't been as much of was maybe a critical assessment or trying to figure out how things worked in practice. So I felt like what I brought to it with this architectural approach was, how could we understand the conditions that people dealt with a little bit better? It's easier to focus on the company owners where there's more records. It's less easy to understand how things were for the average worker within that industry. So I felt like by looking at the mill villages in the woods, by looking at the worker housing in Eureka or south of Market, we could get a better sense of how people lived, what was important to them, what their options were, how they dealt with the things they had to deal with in that setting. Again, there's a lot of material about the facts, and there's been less sort of critical assessment about what the lumber industry meant for the people involved in it and what it might have meant to California in general.
We're talking about this, and I'm rewatching. It's been, I think it's 100 years. No, is it 100 years? Anyway, I'm rewatching Robert Altman's filmography, and right now I'm watching McCabe and Mrs. Miller and thinking that was a gold rush town, but it's similar in that kind of flavor of getting that feeling for what it was like out there. I want to ask you at the beginning of the book, you introduce a conceptual tool, and I think it's important to unpack it, where you talk about the cultural geography of lumber. Why was it important to use that tool, and what's its explanatory power here?
The idea I have in assessing this history is to use space. And by that, I don't mean just architecture, but how people traveled, how people related to each other across space. in a way, I boil it down to the essence is places are connected. And that doesn't sound very novel or interesting, but to me, it is interesting as I looked into this to see how the lumber company owners in Humboldt County were always working with a partner in San Francisco on what's the market like? How can we get new technology involved? All these sorts of things. So for me, it was important to see these two places that we don't usually put together, the Hinterland Resource Site and the Metropolitan Center, as connected and related. Cultural geography is a great way of trying to look at how people develop their environments based on various conditions. And for me, of course, it's a business environment and trying to figure out how people are responding to their environment and how they're creating the kinds of worlds that they need to make it work. In particular, I use a French theorist, Henri Lefebvre, who has this great concept of the production of space.
I'm glad you said his name, because I've read his name but never said it out loud. So I appreciate
it's,
now that I
it's,
can pronounce
it.
Those
French, yeah, you carded
yeah,
it.
There's a lot of consonants right next to each other, so it's always
exactly.
a little nerve-wracking. Yeah.
Exactly.
Anyway, continue, please.
But he's a Marxist in the 60s and 70s, and he's saying the conditions of our lives really frame how the environment works. And he's saying you've got to look at what's going on. Different kinds of conditions create different kinds of environments. So to me, that was a good prod to say, what are the social conditions that are going on here? What do the companies decide they need in terms of where the operations are, what kinds of operations they have? Then how do the workers respond to that? What kind of options do they have? What do they have to deal with in terms of that? So for me, that was a good way to try and get involved in what you might call the lived space, the lived environment of everybody involved. So I look at the homes of company owners, and I look at the homes of company workers and compare and contrast what's going on with that. The other kind of model that I used is a great book by the historian William Cronin, who's an environmental historian. And he wrote a great book a long time ago called Nature's Metropolis that looks at Chicago and its environs. And being an environmental historian, he's interested in how people from Chicago reached out and grabbed all the natural resources in the region around Chicago. And he has these great bank records of people getting financed to go up to the woods in the Great Lakes and get a lot of lumber, or go out on the farms and get a lot of grain. And he traces how these resources get pulled into Chicago and get milled and processed into products. Because he's an environmental historian, he's not quite as interested in the built environment. So for me, I feel like what I'm adding is, yes, it's that same Nature's Metropolis kind of model, but we're looking more carefully at what kinds of built environments or what kinds of architecture result from that processing and that environmental process going on.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's a helpful tool to look at cities like an octopus, where you have that center area,
right,
but then they can't exist without the tentacles that reach out to the natural environment to extract resources to allow it to exist. Let's talk about the gold rush. So a lot of people came west for gold. That didn't pan out, no pun intended, for many people. And then lots of other things start to get commodified with agriculture, partly due to the Central Pacific's expansion and the Central Valley is important. But logging quickly becomes important because you have a large population of people moving and you have to build things quickly. So can you talk about the process of lumber's commodification? How rapid was that?
Sure. So you're right. The gold rush sets everything off, but then there's all these other industries that branch off now that we have the ball rolling in California. So like almost every other industry, the first loggers of the redwood forest come from back east, and they get frustrated in the gold fields, and they say, hey, we have experience in lumber in Maine or in Nova Scotia. And they hit the redwoods and go, oh my God, this is not a little white pine tree back home. This is a huge resource. And so there's a long process of trying to figure out, how do you even do this? How do you get it to the ground? How do you pull it to some place where you can get it milled? How do you get it to market? So there's an ongoing process of experimentation for a while. and they develop new technologies that are important. One of
James, let me
them,
jump in real quick because I want to
yeah,
ask you a question about something you just
sure.
said. It was my next question. So forests on the East Coast are so much different. You've got a lot of deciduous hardwoods, your oaks, your maples, your hickories, a lot of mixed conifers. They grow quickly,
Yep.
whereas redwoods grow quickly, but they take longer to reach full status or whatever the word would be.
Right.
So does that difference between the lumber available, because you have just all these transplants arriving, right? And they have assumptions that they bring from Maine with them, but the forest composition is so much different. Did that have impacts on the logging industry?
There's a difference between the redwoods and a lot of the forests, the pine forests in California, which those trees are probably bigger than a lot of the trees back east, but they do have more of the rhythm that you're talking about. And there's a lot of it. So I think there's a difference between people who are logging the pine forests in the Sierras and trying to figure out how to do the redwoods. One of the real problems was once you get the tree down and cut up, how do you get it to market? And at first, they're using ox teams and horse teams, very slow. One of the lumbermen figures out if you take a steam engine and make it stationary and have a really strong cable, you can pull things across the forest. And this is called the dull beer donkey after the guy that named it and invented it. And so this really changes the nature of the forest and speeds up the processing. And then after that comes railroads. Oh, railroads are big enough to haul these big trunks as well. So what we're seeing over time is a process of speeding up the production, speeding up the logging and the destruction of the forest. And so people are always adapting and trying to figure out how to get more wood out of that forest as fast as possible.
I want to talk about land ownership in California. We've had a lot of discussions on this podcast about the changes after California was conquered and Spanish land grants and Mexican land grants. And then you also have indigenous people living throughout California. I know there was indigenous people living in the redwoods near these areas. And I have less experience directly with north of the Bay Area and much more knowledge about stuff that's more on the Oregon border with the Tallawa tribes and some of the more northern California tribes. But my understanding is that it was migratory patterns of living based on salmon runs and things like that. Can you talk about the people there that were living there before the logging industry arrived and what that kind of like interaction looked like between them?
Yeah, unfortunately, the story is as grim as other places in California in terms of the displacement and outright murder of the people who were already there. So the Tallawa people were there, Yurok, Hupa people. There were several distinct cultural groups, but as you say, most of them lived in the rhythms of nature. They got resources from the sea, they got resources from the forest, and they moved around based on the seasons and where they could get those kinds of resources. They had no relationship with a capitalist economy and trying to extract resources. And obviously, there was a real disconnect between the people who were coming and the people already there. There was physical displacement and there were hunting parties. It was a terrible situation, and it's as bad a story as any that we've seen in California and removal of the native people. There are still groups there. There was a reservation formed, the Hooper Reservation, I think in the 1860s. So people were resettled there. But it's a grim story that we're familiar with from a lot of the Western story.
I know redwoods too are one of those keystone species where they can be a central thing in an ecosystem. And so I imagine that there was lots of both proximal but also distributed effects of getting of removing these massive redwoods that had essentially created their own environment around themselves. Can you talk about that for a moment?
Yeah, it's interesting that the native people didn't bother to try and cut them down. They just fell. There's a lot of fallen trees in the redwood forest. And so they used that. They built slab houses, slabs of wood, and built these really interesting three-sided houses with only one entrance and a round entrance in the front. So, in terms of the resource itself, you're asking about
What
exactly.
were some of the distributed effects beyond just the loss of trees? I know that when you take out something that's a center place in an ecosystem, there are effects because there are people, or not people, excuse me, flora and fauna that survive based
Right.
on this keystone species.
Yeah. I think we've seen this more and more over time, and it's really evident now that as we've gotten into a process of clear cutting, that you affect the soils, you affect the streams. And as people were beginning to criticize this kind of large scale logging, in the end of the 20th and of the 21st century, we were seeing how the silting up of streams, the loss of fish because of that, were getting pretty extreme. And so the more we've been able to cut down these trees faster, the more the effects we've seen of what happens in the other kinds of environments and ecosystems around the redwoods have affected it.
Okay, let's talk about moving redwood. You hinted at this already, but I want to talk about a few different patterns of moving the wood because it's very fascinating. What are the downsides of using waterways to transport logs? I imagine there's quite a few, but I'd be curious for you to explicate that.
Of course, people coming from the east were used to that because they had big rivers that they could put their slightly smaller logs on and move them more easily. We have a lot of seasonal streams. So in California, they had to wait until the rainy season and then wait for a flood to take these trees down to where they were going. It wasn't as effective with something as huge as redwoods because there weren't that many streams where that could happen. In the early days, the redwood lumber people would cut along the coast, and there would be ships that would come up from San Francisco. And you may have seen this where they have long cables that go from a cliff out onto the deck of a boat. So that was very dangerous and exciting way of doing it. But as they cut down the trees along the coast, they had to go further inland. As I mentioned, they had to find other ways of doing it, whether it was ox teams on a skid road, or on the cables with the steam donkeys, or with railroads were a way that they moved the trees over time.
One of the really interesting things was learning about private railways. I'm less familiar with them, industry railways. I know in some of my research on the history of Yosemite, we looked at private donkey trails or horse paths, or that's how everything starts before the government raises taxes and builds things, or you have industry that gets kickbacks from the federal government to build things or whatever. Eventually, it always starts as private. But what are the biggest differences people should know with a private rail line that's created by a lumber company versus like what the Central Pacific did in the Central Valley?
So as these lumber companies were acquiring more timber further inland, they had to figure out how to get their lumber to their mill and then to the shipping. And so they would build, a lot of them were narrow gauge railroads, and the expense was phenomenal, which tells you how much money they were making. So if you're a small partnership in Humboldt County and you've got a huge stand of timber, you've got to figure out how to get to market somehow. They would get locomotives from Philadelphia. They would hire huge crews to construct these tracks through very difficult territory, swampy, hilly. So it was a huge expense, but it was worth it because they were making so much money on this redwood timber. That's how they figured it. They could get it to the market most easily.
I loved learning about the versatility of redwood. I will admit I didn't know as much about it, and I was astounded by its array of uses. I didn't realize what makes it so versatile to allow it to be used for everything from piping to building materials.
So the first aspect is that it grows very tall without any branches until the very height of it. So you've got a huge expanse of wood that is free of knots, that is just clear lumber. So that's valuable in itself. Then it turns out that redwood has some chemical properties that some tannins that resist insects more than usual. And there are some, not complete, but some fireproof qualities to it. So there's a famous pictures after the earthquake in San Francisco of a block on one side that it burned down, the other side, these were built of redwood, so they didn't burn. That's not completely true, but there were aspects of that. And then, as you note, it's relatively waterproof. And so one of the biggest uses of it were for water tanks and for piping before we really had the metal kinds of containers that we have today.
Now, water resistance is relative. I'm about to bring up the 1906 fire. So when we say, or excuse me, not what fire resistant, that's what fire resistance relative. Now, I'm about to talk about the 1906 fire. So when you say fire resistant relative to other kinds of wood or relative to other forms of substance, like how fire resistant was it truly?
If you look at the trees in the forest, evidence of big forest fires, and the trees survive. They have very thick bark, for one thing, and apparently there are some qualities of the wood that aren't as flammable as other kinds of wood. pine or Douglas fir, for example. So that's where people were very interested in using it in construction in San Francisco because of these potential qualities to be at least less flammable than other kinds of materials would be.
Okay, let's jump into the 1906 fire. And I've got a kind of a weird, I know historians don't like counterfactuals, but that's why I like asking them counterfactual questions. And as soon as I was told they don't like it, that makes me want to ask more. So this is a strange question. I'm going to ask it. If we don't have the 1906 fire and then we don't have the subsequent industry buildup to replace a lot of the buildings that were torched, do we not have redwood conservation like we have in California?
Let's see how to answer this.
Because there's a clear line for me, right? With the fire, lumber industry needs to expand and build more quickly. And then because of that ramp up and expansion, we get conservation efforts in response. So it's
I
almost
don't
like they're
see
connected.
the through line there
Okay.
exactly.
Okay.
To some degree, yes. But by the 1880s, especially as Southern California is expanding, there's tremendous production. That's when the first thoughts of, hey, we could potentially blow through this whole forest at some point. California establishes a forestry commission. They don't really do anything in the 1880s, but there's thought about this. So if we don't have the earthquake and fire and the resulting production, I think we still have a problem that people begin to think about after World War I. And it has to do with all sorts of resources. But of course, we have Gifford Pinchot in the East Coast, who goes to Germany, learns about scientific forestry, and then says, oh, let's do this kind of thing. And he's helpful in beginning the Forest Service and the Park Service and saying, these are natural resources we want to conserve. So, yeah, about 15 years after the 1906 earthquake, where we've replaced a lot of it, there is this concern. I'd say it's going to happen anyway because people are beginning to realize we are cutting at such scale that we could conceive. We didn't think this was true for the last 100 years, but now we begin to think it's possible that we could deplete this resource.
Can you give people a sense of the scale of what lumber industry took after 1906 when it really ramped up in that area? Can you just to, for give people a visual of what we're talking about in terms of scale and excavation or extraction?
I don't think that's what I'm saying. I don't think that after 1906, there's tremendously more production or destruction of the trees than has been going on for the last 40 years or so.
Okay.
1880s are when things are really ramping up and down after that time. And yes, 1906 was probably more than the annual cut any time before, but it really kicks off this whole idea. And part of what I found in my research was that the industry are a lot of small partnerships up until about 1900. And in the 1890s and first decade of the 1900s, there's a lot of consolidation, and people are realizing there's so much we have to do. There's so many railroads. There's no railroad to San Francisco until 1914, so we have to buy our own ships and ship it down to San Francisco. That people realize, just like US Steel or Dow Chemical, if we consolidate, it'll be easier to get this cut done. So really what we're seeing in the 1900s, early 1900s, is consolidation and increase of production. And then, of course, I find that's when they start building these company towns because lumberjacks and mill workers have been not really itinerant, but they've been not the most reliable workers. And they realize if we're going to be cutting on this scale, we need to make sure we have people that we trust, the good people, they're going to stay there. They start building housing for married workers. They start building a theater so people can enjoy their lives to stick with the company. So these are the kind of changes that we're seeing by the turn of the 20th century.
Let's imagine you and I took a walk through Pacific Heights. What percentage of the houses am I going to see that are built with redwood in that neighborhood?
I think anything before 1930 is probably most likely going to be a lot of redwood. In the early 20th century, the Douglas fir mills up in Washington and Oregon begin to have rail connections that redwood hasn't had. So we see more use of wood from the Northwest at that time. But I still think people are used to using redwood. They feel like it has good quality. So we're going to see a lot of redwood in those homes.
Is there anything exterior wise that would indicate to me that it was redwood relative to other forms of building material?
Probably not, because it's stained or it's painted in certain ways, so you really couldn't tell that from the outside.
Okay. Let's jump into a couple broad topics. Do you think, and this is interesting because we're going to contrast some legacies here. Do you think the success of the conservation and preservation movements have in some ways caused us to overlook some of the harmful histories of logging?
Let me get that. So the history of conservation.
Yeah. Let me ask my second question first then, because okay. I think that would clarify. If we look at the mineral extraction of the gold rush in the logging industry, why do you think logging figures less centrally in people's understanding of California as a state? The gold rush is this kind of central focal point for, it becomes a metaphor for metaphor of extraction and wealth and pursuing wealth. But logging figures less centrally in people's minds. And so in some ways, I was wondering if that was the success of the conservation and preservation movement, but also the fact that it's a renewable resource, whereas minerals are a non-renewable resource.
Well, let me just take some random shots at it here.
Okay.
Let's look at gold. The value of an ounce of gold versus an ounce of wood, you've got a huge impact with gold. It's much more valuable on a weighted basis. People get really excited about gold and discovery of it. You have huge impacts that are evident right away. The placer mining, the use of those water guns to take down whole hillsides that winds up fouling the streams all the way to Sacramento and ruining farms in the Central Valley. We see huge environmental effects quickly from that. I don't think that we see that because we have so many woods, so many forests, and it doesn't seem like we're going to tear them all down. We don't see the same kind of concern until later. And so when we get to those consolidated corporations that are doing mass production and doing incredible amount of logging, we begin to see that destruction that people finally say, oh yeah, this could be the same kind of effect. But you're right, we think about the gold rush is everyone's prime historical knowledge of California. We focus on that first. And maybe the logging industry is more over time and not until recently do we think about this is the same kind of environmental destruction potentially.
Well, let me ask you about current events. And I'm curious how this book would inform how you view things. With the recent election of Donald Trump, there's been a lot of pushback on NEPA, which is our kind of national preservation apparatus. And then just in your neighbor neck of the woods, Representative Weiner proposed rolling back some elements of CEQA, certain environmental impact reports that are multiplied and doubled as you're building projects in an effort to expand housing stock but just make things easier to build in California. So if you were to take your book as a case study in thinking about development, history, politics, industry, how does that inform the way you see a lot of these discussions going on right now about how should we think about the environment relative to human needs?
One of the ways that I assess the connection between the forest and the city is to look at supply chains. I call them value chains because they're more about adding value at each level of production. But here we are just this week, back in the news. Donald Trump wants to increase our logging. We don't want to have Canadian lumber. We want to have our own lumber. So we're back into, is forest destruction worth it for what we're getting? And so a lot of what I think the relationship of my book to current thinking is, how are these places connected? How are our cities connected to our forest? So yes, if we're going to be cutting down more of our own forest, if we're going to be reducing regulations so we're able to use natural resources without the same kind of protections in order to build our cities, we have the same kind of nexus that we're hurting one place to try and solve another problem in another place. So for me, the basic thought in my book is everything is connected. And that when we do something in one place, we do it in another. I also think about this in terms of Bay Area. If you have coders in India who are doing some product that's sold by a software company in California, you see those same long-term distance effects. It's going to be the same in anything that we do, especially involved with natural resources.
And it's interesting, too, if you contrast it maybe or compare and contrast it with the Owens River Valley and water in Southern California, it seems like it's a kind of a parallel story. Do you see differences or similarities there that you would identify?
The water story in California, government is much more involved. And so you have Mulholland and others who are taking the water for a municipal purpose. There's a lot of private gain from it. The woods, going back to other conversation, it just seems like they're there, and there's not as big a deal about trying to corral them for a public purpose because they just keep producing until the 1920s when people say, this may not be the same. So I think there's a difference between the public purpose and some use of resources and the kind of continued, yeah, the private sector will keep giving us this resource in terms of the logging industry.
Okay, last kind of current relevance. And I think about this too when I think about Eat Local or those campaigns. And I also think about a lot of the very progressive climate goals that the state has established. It seems like you would want to utilize materials nearby because there it takes a lot of fossil fuels to transport, building materials across continents. So how do you think about that in the context of your research?
If you have a resource that you use locally, there's less transportation cost, a potential less energy cost to use something local. On the other hand, if you have a limited resource locally and using that up quicker, does Canada have bigger forests? Probably. They have more forest resources. Does it make sense for us to have less impact globally by using a resource that's more common elsewhere versus cutting down the resources that we have close by? That's an economic trade-off we have to sort out and try and figure out.
David Ricardo,
There
specialization.
you go.
So I ask everyone this, and I'm curious, how has this research on this book changed the way California history?
There's more than the gold rush. What I
Yeah.
really enjoyed is seeing these characters that we don't really know anything about. There was a family in San Francisco called the Hoopers that were like the total entrepreneurs of the logging industry, and no one's ever heard of it. One of the buildings I used to describe this story is the house that the Hoopers lived in on Rincon Hill, small, not very noticeable, modest. And then at a certain point, they build one of the biggest mansions on Pacific Heights, showing how much their business has grown, how much effect that they've had. And they go through history. They develop a lot of different companies over time. They're one of the first groups to start selling redwood in Southern California as building material. There are many more people than just the gold rush figures that we know about. It's interesting to see them. The other aspect is, again, the labor aspect and what do people deal with? How are they dealt with as the industry turns, as people try to do different ways of logging, changing their regimen? How do labor people respond to that? And it's interesting to try and figure out their stories in ways we haven't been able to see so much by using the ordinary architecture.
Were there things that you discovered in your research that you, and this happens with everybody, that you're like, we need more writing on X. We need more research in this area. I find anytime you walk into an archive, you open up an intellectual tributary in your mind where you're like, okay, I could follow this path. Or what were some things that came up in your research that you think we need further writing about?
Well, I just couldn't believe how many lumber company records were at the Bancroft. And I could only, my only time to do some of them, but I think there's a lot somebody could do, enthusiastic graduate student, to try and figure out what was going on, what the trends were in business. I was inspired by a historian, Daniel Cornford, who was at San Jose State, who did a lot of work on labor in the lumber industry. And I just think I scratched the surface. There's so much more at trying to figure out why there was no ability to really organize in the Redwood Forest versus the building trades in San Francisco, where they're most organized in the country. And why couldn't there be connections between those? Why wasn't there some sort of ability for that transfer up to the forest to see why people couldn't organize more? So, yeah, tons of things you just unturn when you're in the archive, and much more to do.
So in some ways, the kind of the forest is this quote third space that's outside of like these jurisdictions. So maybe there's just different rules that apply. Is that where your thinking would be and why the labor organization there wasn't as much labor organization in the forest?
Two things. One, the forest is very isolated, so you have lots of camps in various places, and you see the IWW organizers are tromping all over the North Coast trying to get people organized. The other is that until we have the consolidation into modern corporations, there was a lot of paternalism among the lumber company owners. So I talk about the Carson Mansion, which is one of the few buildings sort of everyone knows on the North Coast. Very ornate, very tall, very prominent on the skyline of Eureka. And the point was, I'm here, I'm your employer. I have so much money, I can build this fancy house, and I am going to be your wages into the future. So I think there was a real effort to try and not co-opt necessarily, but encourage people to think about where their money was coming from and that they relied on the company. So maybe you shouldn't listen to that organizer who might not be in your best interest.
Okay. We close this podcast every time with book recommendations. This is my favorite section. I'm a librarian. What are a few books, either on these topics or others, you'd like to recommend to the audience?
I mentioned William Cronin's Nature's Metropolis.
I
Another
love William.
book.
I could read anything.
He's just a great writer and even better
Changes of
speaker. So any
is it called
Changes of the
Changes of the
Land, Changes of the
Land?
Land. I know
Yeah.
he's done so many different kinds of history so well. It's great. Another great historian, local guy, Gray Brecken. If you haven't read Imperial San Francisco, you should. And if you haven't heard him speak, you should go hear him speak because he's really one of our best storytellers and historians. So that's more of a how the elites reached out into all the resources of the West and brought them here and made their own environment. That's an important one. There's two books on the Redwoods if you're interested in that. One is the most recent by Greg King called The Ghost Forest, Racists, Radicals, and Real Estate in California. He was a participant in a lot of the politics of this over the last 20 or 30 years. So he's got real insight and he deals with everything from the environmental effects to this amazing story of how these eugenicists got involved with Save the Redwoods and saw that saving the Redwoods was like saving the white race. It's a terrible, awful story, but he gets into that. And another one is by Darren Spece, Speece, called Redwood Wars. And my book ends about 1930 because the Depression changes everything. Spece talks about the history of everything as it fell apart. Judy Berry, Julia Butterfly, all the fight, Redwood Summer, all those issues that have been more recent in terms of trying to protect the environment of the Redwoods.
Do you like the writing of John Muir?
Of course, he's
Okay.
amazing.
Yeah,
Temples of Nature.
is there something you prefer amongst his writing?
Maybe I think you can jump in anywhere and just get
Yeah.
this sense of the excitement and the value of nature on its own. And California is a special place. So, yeah, it's wonderful stuff.
Yeah, I find that not that Muir's fiction, but like dipping into more poetic ecological writing. I just did a podcast with Jack Gedney, who wrote great books about bird life in California, our symbiotic relationship with our Western oak trees. And I find that such a helpful kind of complement to a lot of our kind of more traditional historical writing. I think the best book about trees I've ever read is still Richard Powers' The Overstory, which is incredible. I haven't read his Ocean book yet, but because I'm not emotionally ready for that at the moment. But there's so much great writing about trees, and they figure so centrally in our lives. And I was actually just arguing about trees this morning because I was walking into my library and I saw some maintenance crews topping a tree, which is about the worst thing you can do for the life of a tree. And so I think we need a lot more knowledge of lumber, but a lot more knowledge of just trees in general because they make up our physical landscape so centrally.
I'll give you another one. Jared
Okay.
Farmer, Trees in Paradise. He
Trees in
takes a
paradise.
species of trees and talks about it in various, mostly in California, but the politics and the life of the trees as well. So that's a good book.
All right, Dr. Buckley, what are you working on next?
I, as someone involved with vernacular architecture and cultural landscape, there hasn't been a sort of summary of this field for a long time. So I'm trying to gear up now that this book is done to see if I can write some larger text about how we use this kind of resource and how we do this kind of work. It seems daunting, but maybe I'll pull it together and figure out how to make that happen.
We'll be excited to read it when it does come. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me. The book is incredible. I think it does a lot more than just talk about lumber. It really talks about California and what California is. So again, the book title is City of Wood, San Francisco and the Architecture of the Redwood Lumber Industry. Dr. Buckley, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thanks for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider supporting us by either giving us a rating and review or by making a financial contribution at our Patreon page, which is www.patreon.com/historyofcalifornia. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.